And we look, as you know, at a global liquidity cycle, which has a sort of frequency of about 5 to 6 year gyrations. And that cycle bottomed in October of 2022, but it's been rising pretty consistently ever since. And you'll see a chart, which one of the charts I sent over, which actually will show very clearly that cycle of liquidity. I mean, Bitcoin's picked up substantially. You've seen gold pinning all-time highs, the S&P is an all-time high. You know, what's not to like, really? And what this is really saying is that no one tackles the debt problem. Mandatory spending grows exponentially, as it is on course to do. No one's got any incentive to raise taxation here, particularly when you've got a very polarized electorate that can clearly swing either way. No candidate's going to say they're going to raise taxes, because that would be the death knell of their presidency bid. So broadly speaking, what you've got is politicians kicking the can down the road, and the only thing they can do is basically monetize the debt, and that's what is going on here. So we're in a very new world.
Welcome back to Theia. This is Joe Consorti. Today, I have the pleasure of sitting down with a longtime guest of mine and a good friend, Michael Howell, the founder of Cross Border Capital and author of Capital Wars. Michael, it's been a while. How have you been?
I've been pretty good, Joe. Good to see you, and looking forward to the chat.
Likewise. So the last time we talked was 5 months ago. It was early May. A lot has unfolded since then, both domestically, here stateside, and abroad, over in the East. So what's unfolded since then with global macro and global liquidity?
Well, hey, quite a lot, I would say. A lot of water has gone under the bridge, so to speak. I mean, basically what we've had is central banks have begun cutting interest rates with some gusto. They're actually doing even more than that, because they're actually telling us that they're going to be cutting in the future, which is kind of a new theme for them, because they've always really been data dependent. And we're always told that policy decisions are made by committee. So when Jay Powell or the governor of the Bank of England stand up and say, well, look, you've got to expect another 25 basis points next meeting, we know that central banks really mean business. And certainly they have been. They've certainly been cutting. But the whole narrative has been one where global liquidity has basically been picking up quite substantially over this period. And we look, as you know, at a global liquidity cycle, which has a sort of frequency of about 5 to 6 year gyrations. And that cycle bottomed in October of 2022, but it's been rising pretty consistently ever since. And you'll see a chart, with one of the charts I sent over, which actually will show very clearly that cycle of liquidity. So you can see again the bottom, and that increase in the cycle is slated to hit a figure, a peak sometime around late 2025. The issue is that, we've seen markets generally move up, in pretty straightforward fashion, kind of unchallenged by many other events through this year. It's been a good year for investors, certainly in risk assets. I mean, Bitcoin's picked up substantially. You've seen gold pinning all-time highs. The S&P is an all-time high. What's not to like, really? Against that backdrop, economists have been, pretty downbeat about economies. A lot of people have been fearing recession, which clearly hasn't played out. But, at the end of the day, the best time for risk assets is when policymakers are trying to goose sluggish economies. And that's exactly what we've got right now. And, that's really what's backing these decent markets. The problem is when you get into 2025, I think that the situation starts to deteriorate somewhat. And I always fall back on, a saying of an old client of mine many years ago, who said, look, I lose most of my money when the economic outlook goes from really, really awful to just bad. He used a slightly more unpoetic, but anyway, you get the idea. He makes most money when it goes from terrible to just bad, and he loses most money in markets when it goes from excellent to just good. And that's really the problem. We've got to be cognizant of these inflections. And if the economic or market outlook starts to go from excellent to just plain good, we've got to be wary of an inflection. I think if you actually look at the next slide, what we've got there are the challenges out there, which are basically showing what could face markets in 2025. Now, I'm not getting bearish yet. We're still in a risk on mode, and we fully expect markets to keep making new highs over coming weeks and months. But I think you've got to face up to the fact that 2025 will probably be not as straightforward as this year. And you've got three big challenges out there, which are going to affect all risk assets in different measures, but they're going to start to impact. One of those is the Chinese situation. A lot of people have been arguing recently that China has got out the bazooka. The problem is that it may be looking down the wrong end of the barrel. And, you know, this is equivalent to shooting yourself in the foot, but actually magnified many times. I think they're doing the wrong thing, but, you know, hey, we'll see. The other is you've got embedded inflation problems in the West, not least in the US, where, you know, I would figure that underlying inflation is definitely 100 basis points higher than the Fed is telling us. So it's nearer 3 than 2. Now, that may not be a big step, but it's certainly something, I think, to worry markets. And then you've got this other bogey, which is coming up later on the horizon, but it's still a big, big issue, which is the whole need to refinance debt, particularly when you've got a large maturity wall upcoming. And the problem that we foresee is that markets may crash into that maturity wall. That's a problem. Markets need liquidity, and debt refinancing actually absorbs a lot of that surplus liquidity. So those are the challenges out there as far as we can see.
Fantastic. So if you don't mind, how about we break down each of these, starting with Chinese demand? So we talk about what happened in China. There were a lot of sensationalist headlines early last month when this occurred, toward the end of the month when it was announced. You do a great job at unpacking a lot of the sensationalism. What actually was the response from China, and why do you think it was the wrong move that they made?
Okay, well, let me first of all sort of explain the background that we've got there. What China is basically seeing is a situation that hit Japan, hit the Asian emerging markets, actually, for record, hit the Scandinavian economies, all around about the early to mid-1990s. And that was a problem of bubble economies, inflated real estate, and as those bubbles burst, you start to see debt deflation emerging. Now, the only way out of debt deflation is essentially to devalue your currency, or more particularly, if you look at it in a more generalist way, the solution is that the real exchange rate has to fall. Now, the real exchange rate has two components to it. One is the notional or nominal exchange rate, so the Chinese yuan in this particular case. And the other element, the other moving part, is the Chinese price level, which you've got to include in that asset prices as well as high street prices. Now, if you've got this problem of debt deflation and the deflating bubble going on, either the nominal exchange rate has to go down to correct things, or the price level has to fall. And what we're seeing in China is they're holding up the exchange rate, and they're basically letting prices, or have let prices, and they've let asset prices tumble significantly. Now, there's only so far you can let these things drop, because if you get deflation, as you know, people stop spending, because if you're going to buy something, today, which is going to cost you 5 or 10% less in a year's time, you're going to hold off your purchases, unless you have to buy right now, of course. So purchases get delayed and economies slow down even more. And it's the same with asset prices. What's the point in holding an asset that's deflating? People just lob it and you get further deflation. And that's the problem. These things are cumulative. So China needs to step in and stop this process abruptly. Now, what they're trying to do with this is they've announced a major, or they are in the process of announcing, let's be clear, because they haven't come up with the numbers yet, just the idea they're going to do something, with fiscal packages. Now, first of all, those fiscal packages are small. So far, they're talking maybe 1 trillion, possibly 2 trillion yuan, which is probably, let's be realistic, at most half a trillion US dollars. If you're looking at that in context, going back to 2008, the US lobbed in somewhere between 2 and 3 trillion to offset the problems, the debt problems in the great financial crisis in 2008-09. What's more, a lot of that was monetized by the Fed. So in the situation you've got in China now, first of all, the scale of the response is smaller. And secondly, what they've said is they're not going to monetize it. They said that there's no implications for an expansion in the PBOC balance sheet. But that is exactly what's needed. What they need is more liquidity in the economy, ironically, to try and get the exchange rate down and to try and stop prices continually falling. So what they're doing at the moment is actually likely to cause more of a squeeze because as the economy picks up and fiscal spending starts to get traction, there'll be greater demands for credit within the economy. So this is a problem. Now, there's a chart which sort of illustrates part of these issues a little bit later, which is an orange chart that's got an orange background at least, which looks at Chinese liquidity injections. And if you can find that one, I'll tell you when to draw a halt, but it's there we are. So what this chart here looks at is liquidity injections by the People's Bank of China. And this is daily data. As you can see, it's measured in billions of yuan. And the graph line is showing how much money they're actually sticking into the markets on a daily basis. Now, what we've done is looked at the latest period, the latest observations of the first half of October. And what that illustrates, without any question, is where is the bazooka? It looks like it's pointing in the wrong direction. It's going down, not up. So they're actually taking money out of money markets. And that would seem to suggest to me, at least, that what they're doing is they're honoring their statement that the BOJ balance sheet's not going to expand. In fact, here it's likely to decrease. And what's more, they're really trying to underpin the Chinese yuan, which is exactly what they don't want to do, because we know that the remedy for all these other debt deflations worldwide has been currency devaluation. And so that's really what China needs to do. And they're not. But what are the implications of that? Well, if you look at the next slide, you'll see the sort of the ominous picture, which is potentially unfolding. Now, this is not going to be exact, and maybe the analogy or the association will break down, but we've got to be cognizant of this because it's a whopping great risk. And let me explain what this chart is. The orange line again is liquidity injections, the same data, in fact, that we were just looking at in orange. It's been advanced here by 3 months. And what it's graphed against is a nowcast of world GDP growth. So that's the black line, and that's shown as, in terms of percentage growth year on year. A nowcast is something which is a sort of computer simulation that takes into account lots and lots of data on different things like commodity prices or economic releases, etc. And it comes up with its best guess as to what is the current tempo of the economy. And what you can see is that the gyrations in the world economy appear to be led a few months prior, given the fact that the orange line is advanced by 3 months, by Chinese liquidity injections, PBOC liquidity injections. Now, first of all, why is that the case? The reason is that China's central bank, the People's Bank, basically controls the tempo of Chinese business. You've still got, essentially, for want of a better description, a state-run economy, and it's very tightly controlled by the authorities. What's more, China has a huge economic footprint. It's the elephant in the room, certainly in the Asian region. And therefore, the changing tempo of the Chinese economy is going to have a major effect on world economic growth, and that's what it seems to be doing. So if the PBOC is turning off the tap, what you may be seeing here is a rather unexpected dip in global economic activity over the next 3 or 4 months. And that's something that policymakers in the West are not going to like too much. And it may mean that it encourages the Federal Reserve and maybe the Europeans to actually double down on their easing. So this is something I think we've got to bear in mind, as it may be something for the future to watch. But the issue and the reason that it's a concern is that it's going against what the current narrative is. You may see bad news before you see good. And there was an example which I can cite, which is what happened the last time China put the brakes on hard and tried to squeeze its domestic industry. In other words, preventing getting credit. That was in 2008. And in 2008, ahead of the global financial crisis, you may recall that there was the Beijing Olympics. And one of the things that the Chinese were very keen on doing was to make this a showpiece event where foreigners couldn't sort of look at the pollution and say, look, this is a terrible country. It's the Olympics are spoiled by smog or whatever it may be. And so they basically tried to turn down the tempo of Chinese economic growth ahead of the games by actually restricting credit to industry to slow the economy down. What that did is it forced Chinese borrowers into the Eurodollar markets to try and get credit in other ways. And that crowded out the Eurodollar markets, which are already under huge pressure from financing mortgage-backed securities in the US. And that was the trigger, not the cause, I'd stress, but it was a trigger, one of the triggers for the global financial crisis later that year. So China can have big effects, and we've got to be very cognizant of that fact.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, it seems to be one of the biggest risk factors, currently when it comes to this global liquidity cycle that you say is set to peak out currently in 2025. And you believe the response from other global central banks, should this easing not be enough in China, which clearly you believe it isn't, will be a doubling down, further easing. I wonder how that will play out in U.S. markets, because currently there's already 150 basis points of cuts priced in, and also markets are pricing in an end of QT very soon. And I know you talked about this during our first discussion this year, where you believe that there would be pressure from the Treasury for the Fed to end QT. How will that go over in U.S. markets if, because China isn't easing hard enough and their economy is slowing down, it's dragging down world GDP, U.S. Is forced to end QT sooner than it might like to and forced to double down on cuts. How do you think that'll go over?
Well, I think if you spelled it out in the fashion you did, very badly, I think that it was that the narrative might be right, but I think they'll change the wording, so it'll more be that there'll be a response to what could be, much slower inflation or even prospects of a slower US economy near term, which will give the Fed its excuse. I think the other thing that you've got to bear in mind is that what's also driving the Federal Reserve and the Treasury for that matter is to make sure that the integrity of the US sovereign debt markets remain intact. And I keep saying, sort of ad nauseam in a way, that although we know that the Fed is supposed to be targeting inflation and it has to, it's got part of its remit is employment too. The reality is, when push comes to shove, all these policymakers basically try to preserve the integrity or the solidity of their sovereign bond markets. The US Treasury market is the most important market worldwide, not just for the US government to fund itself, but also for world investors. It's clearly a benchmark. Throughout history, the most important price in global financial markets has been the price of the dominant economy's debt, and that's the US Treasury yield, particularly on the 10-year note. And if you look at one of the other charts I've got in the presentation, which I think was maybe a tad earlier, we show there a chart of the MOVE index, and you'll see, I think it's about three slides earlier, and what that shows is the movements in the MOVE. Now, the MOVE index, for the uninitiated, is basically like the VIX, but it's for the bond markets. The MOVE index is integral, and I think it's one of the things that the Treasury and the Fed are collectively targeting. This is showing volatility in bonds. I've shaded on that graph the normal zone, which is the gray area at the bottom. The index reads from 0 to 200. If you knock a zero off that index, you get pretty close to what the way to interpret the index, because it's showing 100 means, broadly speaking, or very crudely, 10% implied volatility across the yield curve. 50 would be correspondingly 5% volatility. The long-term average has been about 7% volatility, so it's a 70 index. Generally, I mean, in my time in the bond markets, if it got above about 150, it was turn the lights out time. The authorities really lost control of bonds. You can see that happening a couple of occasions, but generally speaking, what we've been in is an elevated volatility regime for fixed income. Hopefully, it's coming back into that normal zone. Why is it so important? It's very important because it is something that is used for the generation of liquidity, in the sense that if you look at how the liquidity dynamics work, there's a collateral base, and I think I show this a couple of slides earlier as to how we actually think about global liquidity. There's an inverted pyramid you'll see in the previous chart. And what that basically shows is that global liquidity, which is about $175 trillion, what that does is it rests on what we call a shadow monetary base, which consists partly of what the central banks are doing in terms of their balance sheets, the black triangle, but also relies on collateral. And one of the consequences of the 2008 crisis is that most lending now, most advances of liquidity, require collateral backing. And that means a little bit like extending the analogy of a home mortgage. Your home mortgage is lent against the value of your property. In the same way as a loan today would be increasingly backed by, say, a US government bond or a German Bund or whatever it may be as collateral. Now, the amount of or the effectiveness of that collateral depends on the volatility of the collateral. And something called a haircut is given to the collateral value, which means you can either borrow more or less depending on the size of the haircut. And that haircut is directly related to volatility of the asset. So if the MOVE index is elevated, showing you've got elevated or high volatility in the US bond markets, collateral is going to be worth a lot less. And therefore, global liquidity will come down. So these are reasons that it's important. And I think the Treasury and the Fed are targeting lower volatility as best they can. And one of the reasons as well for doing that, from a sort of selfish perspective from the Treasury, is that a lot of the buyers of US government bonds now are hedge funds. Hedge funds are doing an arbitrage trade for the most part. They're selling futures and buying cash bonds. And that really depends on low volatility for that to be sustained. A lot of the long-term buyers of treasuries have kind of been scared off by various things, particularly if you look at the Chinese or the Japanese, they're not buying in the way they were. By default, it's coming that the deficit is being funded more and more at the short end of the market. Now, that matters for inflation, which I know is another issue you want to get onto. But it also matters as well for long-term asset allocation. And if the deficit is being funded more and more and more at the short end, in other words, by bill finance or by the issuance of very short-dated coupons like 2-year, 3-year, 5-year coupon bonds, coupon treasury bonds, the people that buy those bonds tend to be credit providers, particularly banks. And one of the things that you're seeing in the US market as we speak is that something like three-quarters of the increase in US money supply this year has actually been debt monetization of the federal deficit. So, put it in another way, that's printing money. Milton Friedman would be turning in his grave were you looking at these figures. And I think as Stan Druckenmiller, very pointedly put it several months ago, the sort of figures that we're seeing coming out of the Treasury are the sort of figures you'd expect or would have expected some years ago coming out of Argentina, not out of the US Federal Reserve and Treasury. So these are the concerns. And I'm not going to say we're turning into hyperinflation, but clearly the tempo of inflation is likely to be higher, which is why I think you need dedicated monetary inflation hedges in portfolios like gold, i.e., why is gold an all-time high? No secret there. And why is Bitcoin elevated? Also, you can think about buying Treasury inflation-protected securities. If they're yielding near 2%, that's a great bargain.
Absolutely. And so we look at this chart. This is the deficit as a percentage of GDP. I made this in my terminal. And you can see, I mean, historically, the deficit tends to shrink as a percentage of GDP when we're in expansion. It widens out again when we're in recession. It's been getting wider and wider as a percentage of GDP every year. But it seems like this is the widest it's ever been, when we're out of recession. Like, by all accounts, we've been in expansion for quite some time, and we were red hot for a while because inflation was really elevated. And so when you say something like three quarters of the new money supply was debt monetization, that kind of sends alarm bells to me. And the other big issue as well is our interest payments, which you also touched on. We talk about the ballooning debt problem. Another reason that the Fed is cutting interest rates, obviously it has this dual mandate, but it also has this commitment to the US Treasury. When our annual interest expense by the end of the year is projected to be higher than our defense spending, then the Fed, even though it's supposedly this separate institution, has this, mandate to make it so that we don't have to continue monetizing debt at an accelerating pace because of how high this interest expense is. And so these seem to be two extremely big problems that are also driving why the Fed has to cut interest rates now.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely. I mean, whether it's, my perspective is it's not necessarily a question of cutting interest rates. It's actually also a question of expanding liquidity, and I think it's the liquidity dimension which is the important element. And I want to show that in, maybe in a slightly different way, but just to illustrate why this is so important. So if you look at in the slides I've got, the very last slide looks at what the problem is in sort of stark terms. Now, I always try and stress in these presentations that I'm not hitting on the US because there's a lot of countries that are in far, far worse shape than America. But the fact is that the US has very transparent data, and it's very easy to actually look at some long-term projections here. So, the US authorities are very generous in terms of sort of, opening up the books, so to speak. If you look at this chart, what it's basically showing is contributions to US credit growth by decade. And what I've done is I've used projections that come from the Congressional Budget Office for the next 3 decades, the 30s, the 40s, and the 2050s. And one of the things that you can see there is the height of the bar, overall bar is total US credit growth. And the little numbers are the percentage increases per annum on average that you'd expect to see. So, number one is you're seeing a big increase in prospective credit growth. Okay. And the other thing is that the red area is basically showing the contribution of the public sector via the budget deficit to that credit growth. So what you can see if you look at these at the chart, I mean, there's not really a material difference in what the private sector is doing. In actual fact, I've assumed that private sector credit pretty much grows in line with nominal GDP or there or thereabouts. But it's actually the contribution of the public sector, the government, which is really the key thing. And what this is really saying is that no one tackles the debt problem. Mandatory spending grows exponentially as it is on course to do. There's increased defense outlays which are going to come in as well to bite. No one's got any incentive to raise taxation here, particularly when you've got a very polarized electorate that can clearly swing either way. No candidate's going to say they're going to raise taxes because that would be the death knell of their presidency bid. So broadly speaking, what you've got is politicians kicking the can down the road. And the only thing they can do is basically monetize the debt. And that's what is going on here. So we're in a very new world. And that new world basically started in 2008 with the global financial crisis, the bailout there. And it continued in spades with the COVID crisis. And that's pretty much where we are. Now, if you go back a couple of slides, what you'll see is another chart, which is this one, which is basically, again, illustrating the problem. Now, this is trying to emphasize the whole way that financial markets have changed. And this is something which is still not drilled into economic textbooks because they're still talking about capital markets being new financing mechanisms for capital spending, which is the red line that you see on the chart. This is looking at all the advanced economies worldwide, how much money they spend on capital expenditure, that's buildings, new plant and equipment, etc., vehicles. On an annual basis, that red line. Now that's growing, okay, but that's the feedstock for productivity and economic growth. But the brown line above that is basically illustrating the size of the debt roll required every year. Now, what is the debt roll? This is what people talk about in the media about being the maturity wall, but it basically is describing how much debt has to be refinanced each year. Now, if you've got a whopping great stock of debt out there, and the stock of debt worldwide is $350 trillion or so, but the US government is alone is more than 10% of that. That has to be rolled over, periodically. Now, the average tenor of that debt is probably about 6 years or thereabouts, which, very crude maths is sort of telling you've got something like 35, 40 trillion, sorry, beg your pardon, 50 to 60 trillion to roll every year. So these are huge amounts of money, and what you need is balance sheet capacity to do that. Now, the following chart, I believe, in that pack was then saying, well, okay, if you look at, sorry, it's the one at the up there, if you look at that chart there, this is an interesting chart because basically what it says is that debt needs liquidity to roll itself over. So, this thing doesn't happen magically. And what you basically need is balance sheet capacity among financial institutions, particularly credit providers, to facilitate that debt roll, okay, to refinance the debt. And that balance sheet capacity is liquidity. So here is the ratio between debt and liquidity for the advanced economies worldwide. And one of the things that you can see in this chart is that first of all, there seems to be some sort of balance or equilibrium at around about that point that I marked there, about 250, 260 percent of liquidity. So in other words, the debt pile is 2.5 times the liquidity pool. This is adjusted for the maturity of debt, so it takes into account the maturity wall. And this is basically saying that the effective amount of debt that's got to be refinanced spikes up in 2026, and that's the maturity wall that people are thinking about. And that debt will require, will absorb a liquidity from financial assets. So the nearer we get to 2026, the bigger the problem. And that's one of the other things that we're really focused on. So you've got the China bogey, you've got the problem about rising inflation, and will that persuade the Federal Reserve to ease or not, or continue easing in the way that they've done? But I think they're implicitly running with a higher inflation target, but obviously not letting on. And here what you've got is the third problem, which is the need to debt refinance. So this is suggesting to me that 2025 is not going to be smooth sailing. We can still make money next year, but I think you've got to be very alert to what may be dangerous inflections in markets. And these are the three problems that I would highlight. Tactically, we probably want to be a bit cautious as the year progresses. Strategically, the 60/40 portfolio that everyone has sort of grown to love over the last 2 or 3 decades is junk now. You've got to start thinking more seriously about dedicated monetary inflation hedges. And whether that's gold or whether that's Bitcoin, I mean, it's a moot point. But I think on the maybe the second chart in on the pack, I show a little graph that we gave to our investors a few months ago, which illustrates the sensitivity of assets to global liquidity. And this is a whole range of assets. This is just a simple regression analysis, but it's shown over different windows. I mean, it's using for reference, it uses weekly data, and it looks at the sort of average beta against liquidity of those assets. And broadly speaking, what it's saying is that for every 10% increase in global liquidity, or every unit increase in global liquidity, these are the multiple factors that you get. So in other words, if you're looking at gold, you go up about 1.5 times. If you look at silver, it's probably 2 and a bit times. If you look at Bitcoin, this is historic data, you've gone up dramatically more, like 7 times for every unit increase historically. The orange bar is the last 18 months. So one of the things that is true with Bitcoin is you've got a take-up effect as well. So it's something I've called drawing the difference between the intensive and the extensive margin in terms of what holders are doing. But broadly, the orange line is maybe a lot more representative, and maybe you're looking at a higher response rate. But these are demonstrably monetary inflation hedges, and then you've got a whole tail of assets to the right-hand side that are saying this is by way of an increase in global liquidity. These are the sort of responses you would expect. So you want to be looking on the left-hand side of that chart, in my view.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously we see commodities doing decently well. Obviously, just like you said, gold is up in the last month. It's hitting new all-time highs because of reignited global growth and inflation fears. Copper is also doing pretty well over the last month. But again, if we look at these kind of new assets, and Bitcoin itself is a very nascent asset, of course, that's the reason why it has such high sensitivity to a global liquidity shock. I think weighing it over the last 18 months is a really good way of illustrating that as Bitcoin grows, it's going to have a marginally less effective hedge against global liquidity. But nevertheless, gold and Bitcoin seem to be the two winners for right now. And of course, Ethereum is thrown in there as well. But gold, silver, Bitcoin, and then you also put the Bitcoin and gold pair in there as assets that you want to allocate to, if you anticipate a global liquidity shock coming, not commodities or oil. Or even the S&P 500, which historically people have piled into, the historical assets that people use when they expect global liquidity expansion, rather. But we are seeing the emergence of these new nascent assets as the optimal hedge against this global liquidity expansion.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, the following chart shows the long-term response of gold to global liquidity. And what it's demonstrating is that over the long term, we show there that gold, this is the value of gold in terms of the stock of gold worldwide, in orange, charted against the pool of global liquidity. The pool of global liquidity is shown on the right-hand scale. And all it's trying to say is that a lot of the twists and turns that you get in global liquidity tend to be matched by gold. And, not surprisingly in many ways. The dotted line at the bottom is something that is worth pondering on because that is US CPI over the period. In other words, it's liquidity indexed, or the CPI has been indexed back to the same starting point as global liquidity. And that's what you would have seen. So the point that we make frequently is that gold is not a high street inflation hedge, it's a monetary inflation hedge. What drives high street inflation is partly monetary inflation and partly other things, which could be cost changes in the impact of technology, whether China is dumping cheap goods, oil prices going up, taxes rising, etc. So you can see a lot of other things in the cocktail of high street prices that is not only monetary inflation, but gold is definitely a monetary inflation hedge. And that's what Bitcoin, Ethereum et al. Seem to be performing the same role as. So that's why you need to have some sort of diversification into these instruments.
Absolutely. I mean, if you've been looking at one of the things I love about your analysis is that you make it a point to differentiate between monetary inflation and high street inflation. Because if people look at the CPI and they call that their inflation and they buy sovereign bonds that are yielding, right now on the long end, like close to 5%, or anywhere between 2 and 4% as this cycle as rates come down in the US, you're getting killed. Compared to actual monetary inflation versus owning assets like gold and Bitcoin, sure, you don't have necessarily the same guarantees. Like, there isn't a money printer behind, gold or behind Bitcoin, but there is the reality that there's such stark outperformance because they track global liquidity versus things like sovereign debt, which yield far less, and in real terms, more often than not, you're getting killed.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, a lot of people have said, look, inflation's falling this year, therefore we don't need gold. Well, wrong answer. Because actually monetary inflation is accelerating, even though CPI is coming down at a rate. You've got to differentiate these two things. In fact, the next slide is looking at the sensitivity of Bitcoin to changes in global liquidity. And this looks a bit of a noisy chart, but it is noisy, so we've got to accept that. It's looking at very high frequency data, which gives a much clearer idea as to the sensitivities. The price of Bitcoin, this is done about 10 days ago, so it's maybe anticipating the recent rally, who knows? But what it's illustrating is the orange line is the 6 week change in the price of Bitcoin, shown in an annualized rate on the right hand side. And then what you see is the equivalent change in global liquidity on the left-hand scale in black. And what this is really illustrating is that Bitcoin and global liquidity correlate very closely. But what we've done here is that we've advanced the global liquidity series, the black line, by basically 3 months, so 12 weeks. So what you've got is a very clear leading indicator in the global liquidity space on Bitcoin.
Yeah, absolutely. Bitcoin, because and I feel it does the best out of any asset, because it is 24/7, 365. There are no circuit breakers in the market. Obviously, ETFs are playing an increasingly large role, but nevertheless, you can still buy and trade this thing 24/7, 365. And so, I believe for that reason, as well as its absolute scarcity, it makes it one of the best, if not the best, according to your chart that was 2 charts ago. The best kind of fire alarm for global liquidity in the direction of it. It lags very closely behind the moves in the global liquidity cycle, and for that reason, it's something people want to allocate to in the long run. If they do anticipate this problem of accelerating global liquidity expansion to be real, which, given the problems that you've outlined, the debt issue that is facing global sovereigns, and the reality of an increasing amount of that debt over the next 3 decades is going to have to be monetized by those sovereign central banks. Then global liquidity is going to accelerate. And therefore, you want to allocate to the assets that are the best proxy for that global liquidity, like Bitcoin, like gold.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And global liquidity is expanding, as we've said. It's slated to keep going. But if you look at the, you can see why the cycle is turning. If you look at the chart that's on the next page, which is a heat map, which looks at the background of what central banks are doing. Now, at first sight, this may look a bit like an impressionist picture, but broadly what it's showing, or a piece of modern art or whatever, but what it's basically showing is along the north-south axis on the left-hand side is a range of countries organized by regions. The dates run along the top axis, and each of the tiles is looking at a particular month, and it's showing what that central bank was doing in terms of its liquidity injections into markets. So red is they're taking money out, green is they're injecting a lot of money in, and yellow is they're broadly neutral. And you can see as you move here from left to right, the colors change from red to green. And that change in the hues of the chart is basically illustrating that central banks are going from tight. They were sort of maximum tight generally, if you look at that impressionistic chart, around about third quarter of 2022. And then they began to progressively ease up. So this is not just a Fed phenomenon. In actual fact, the Fed has been lagging the general trend. But what you can see here is that, now we're in a situation where, visually it looks a lot more benign. And if you want to put that in sort of a more standard graphical framework, you can see that on the following chart, which is just recording both the size of what central banks are doing, which is the orange line in terms of their liquidity injections, and the number of central banks that are easing, which is shown in that as that dotted line. So it's very clear by number and by value of funds going in, there's a clear easing process underway. And that sort of belies in many cases the fact that, interest rates have only just started to be cut in many countries. In fact, the cycle began largely 2 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. It seems, the Fed was kind of the last mover when it came to easing. You could see in the above chart, they're still yellow compared to the other countries in the Americas, Africa, Asia, and Europe. Over the next couple of months, it's estimated, and I mentioned this earlier, that the end of QT is probably going to happen. Again, we have more Fed cuts on the way. 150 basis points is priced in by the overnight index swaps market between now and next September. What do you think investors need to look out for over the next 3 to 4 quarters when it comes to some of these developments that could happen in the global macroeconomy, how they relate to the global liquidity cycle?
Well, I think in many cases, the most important thing to watch, or the two most important things to watch, would be something like the price of the price of monetary inflation hedges, and you can choose your poison, whether it's gold or whether it's Bitcoin. And the other thing is to try and look at a measure of the volatility of the bond market, which is the MOVE index. The MOVE index is frequently quoted in the media, and it's well worth tracking because the MOVE index is really one of the architects of rising global liquidity. It's going to be very, very difficult to see global liquidity expanding significantly if that MOVE index is moving up, not down. You really needed to come back into that grey area. And I think that what the central banks are doing, or what the Fed and the Treasury in particular are doing, is trying to get that that orange line back into the lower bands. And I think there is a direct attempt to do that. They will inject liquidity, more liquidity, and they will basically try and change the rules in terms of liquidity requirements of banks to try and get there. In fact, if you look at a chart I think there was a chart earlier on the Federal Reserve that I put a few back. That one there, your Fed balance sheet. I mean, what that's showing, just for the record, is looking at the Fed balance sheet, which is the red line. This is the total assets of the Fed. And this is really the headline figure that they often quote to say that they're doing QT, quantitative tightening. Now, the problem with that statement is that it's only quantitative tightening in the sense that arithmetically the balance sheet is coming down in size, but the liquidity generating components of the balance sheet are actually going up. And that's the orange line that we've drawn on the chart. And this was something that, this goes back to my days at Salomon Brothers and trying to understand Fed watching. Fed watching is a crucial art. I wrote this up in a book called Capital Wars about 5 years ago about what to look for. But broadly speaking, what this is orange line is doing is showing the net liquidity injections by the Federal Reserve into the system. And you'll see that where you get the inflection, which coincides largely with two events, one is the British gilt crisis in the fall of 2022, so it's September 22, and the other was the SVB crisis in the spring of the following year. Those are really the two events that caused that inflection in liquidity, and it caused the trend to start driving upwards. Now, the dotted line is our extrapolation to year-end. That is colored by the fact that there's a debt ceiling reimposition on January 2nd, slated for January 2nd, and that will require the Treasury to run down their TGA, the Treasury General Account, at the Fed to what the Congress deemed to be normal levels, normal operating levels, which I would imagine is nearer $250 billion than the $800 billion that currently sits in that account. So as that money gets redeployed into money markets, what you're likely to see is more liquidity coming into the system, and therefore you will likely see bank reserves rising. Now, if you look at the following chart, there's a twist in this analysis, in the sense that one of the things that's been very important to judge is the level of bank reserves in the system, because what we don't want is another SVB crisis, which is where you've got significant bank failures in the spring of 2023. And what this chart is showing in orange is actual bank reserves. The red line, the solid red line, is a one standard deviation drop below that, which is trying to capture the tail of the distribution of reserves into the regional banks. So that is probably the thing to watch more closely. And the dotted line that I put on there is our estimates of adequate reserves in the system. Now, what you can see is that the Fed lately has been sailing pretty close to that boundary, that benchmark, which is why you may have been getting some tensions in repo markets. But there's a step down that we drew on that chart, which came in August, which is when the Federal Reserve, in an FAQ report, a frequently asked questions report, basically said that US banks, for their stress tests, can now include access to the discount window, access to the standing repo facility, and any loans from Federal Home Loan Banks, which are GSEs, government-sponsored enterprises. And those can be included. Therefore, that would suggest that, by implication, the adequate reserve threshold is probably dropped, we think, by maybe $800 billion. And that's our back-of-the-envelope calculation, which means there's a lot more headroom in terms of reserves in the system. So money market liquidity could be improved. In other words, banks have got excess liquidity they could redeploy elsewhere, maybe into the fixed income markets or even into loans.
Fantastic. A lot of alpha here today, Michael. Thank you once again for coming on. As always, it is a pleasure. And every new time you come on, I learn more, and our viewers certainly more to learn more too. I hope to have you on again in the future, maybe in the very near future, because again, things are shaping up to get exciting. It's been a little bit of business as usual over the last, year and a half, 2 years, as easing has happened and growth has been mostly stable. But now, as we are kind of at the inflection point where central banks are easing and they may need to pick up on their easing, and growth is kind of on a bit of a precipice, things are certainly going to get interesting over the next several months. But before we go, any parting thoughts, and then also where people can find you and follow your work?
Well, I think the parting thought is just to keep tabs on global liquidity, because this is the important dynamic that we've all got to understand in terms of asset allocation. It's something that people don't often look at, but I think it's a key thing. As we tried to show in the last few years, it's really been what has moved markets up and down. Where can they find us? The easiest way is probably via our Substack, which is called Capital Wars. There is a Twitter, well, there's a tweeting that occurs via Twitter, which is, the handle is @CrossBorderCap. And we've got an institutional service which is available on www.crossbordercapital.com. So those are the main avenues.
Fantastic. And all of those links will be linked in the show notes below. Michael Howell, again, thank you so much for coming on. Talk soon.
Joe, great pleasure. Thank you.